Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. And joining us today is Maggie Shipset. Maggie is the author of Astonish Me. Her debut novel was Seating Arrangements, and that was the winner of the Dylan Thomas Prize and the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for First Fiction. And Astonish Me is the irresistible story of Joan, a young American ballet dancer. And I'm not going to tell you the rest because Maggie and I are going to sit here and talk about it. And I guess it'll be like I'm talking to Joan because she created the character. Maggie, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thanks for having me, Louis.
Now, first of all, let's talk a little bit about the fact that you decided to write, I guess they're kind of similar. When you first wrote the book Seating Arrangements, it had to deal with people that normally other people don't deal with, rich, well-to-do. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, I hadn't really encountered East Coast WASPs until I went to college. And so I got there, I went to Harvard, and first day there are all these kids wearing pants with whales embroidered on them and needle-pointed belts. And I just thought, who are these people? Like, what does it all mean? So yeah, I think both my books have evolved from having an outsider's perspective on a really specific subculture.
And I think that's the same thing that everybody has. Perhaps somebody from the East Coast, you know, they view California as the crazy, whatever you want to do, surfing, etc. And they view us, the Southwest, as that old Western town, El Paso, that Marty Robbins created. But when you sit down and you write about something that is different from what you've been exposed to, it really is difficult. And from what the critics are saying, this book, as I mentioned, is about Joan Joyce, the protagonist, and she is a ballet dancer. And what I understand is you have no background in ballet, so you did a lot of research.
Yeah, I did. I'm a lifelong ballet fan, which helps. And my mom is a really serious ballet fan. So she started taking me to the ballet when I was about 5, which was right around the time it became clear I would not be a dancer myself. I think I did 1 year of class and had absolutely no talent. So I've been seeing ballet for my whole life and had a familiarity with the discipline that goes into it and what various ballets look like and what it feels like to be an audience member. And this book started as a short story that I couldn't really make work as a story. It was sort of too long and kind of ungainly, and I thought I was working on a different book, and I took a break to revise this story, and it just sort of started to spiral out of control and get longer and longer and longer. And so I really researched as I went along. I'd encounter something I needed to know more about and would dig into it, but most of my research was visual. I watched documentaries about ballet and listened to how the dancers describe their lives, and I watched a lot on YouTube. Some companies put a lot of backstage footage online, which was really helpful. Like the Royal Ballet has an entire company class online, and so I could watch that and listen to how instructors talk to dancers.
A lot of times when people write about certain things that they're not that familiar with, they tend to stereotype. And I think we all stereotype ballet dancers and even male ballet dancers because people think, well, you know, that's so easy and that's not really a sport. But the former Dallas Cowboys great Herschel Walker enrolled in ballet, and he was in the Dallas Ballet, and that was to keep fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ballet is incredibly demanding. They work out as hard as any athlete, and if you think about it, because it's also an art, it'd be like if you were running the hurdles in the Olympics, but you had to keep this sort of smile on your face the whole time and do it gracefully and make it look effortless. I think that's one of the biggest challenges of ballet, is that it has to look effortless, but it's actually just incredibly difficult.
Now, the character you created, Joan Joyce, the protagonist of Astonish Me, loves ballet. And she is good, but not good enough to be a soloist. And so she goes to Russia, I believe, and then she starts dancing with another dancer there?
Yeah, so she's American, and she is talented, but probably isn't going to be a star. And she actually is dancing in Paris, which is where she first encounters this Russian sort of superstar, Arslan Rusakov. And she's drawn to him both just in kind of a basic attraction way, but he also represents all the talent that she wishes she had. So in a lot of ways, the book is about, you know, how do you contend with the limitations of your talent? And at what point is a demanding art form worth it if you're not going to get what you want out of it? So, yeah, from the beginning, I decided to use this character who wasn't going to be a star.
You know, in a way, it's kind of like the Cold War, when we were doing everything that the Russians were trying to do, and we wanted to do it better, and they did it better. And we all know that in the Soviet Union, at least when they were communists, if you were chosen to be an athlete or a dancer, that's all you did. And mm-hmm. they worked and worked and worked on you since you were a child. And in the United States, it was, like you said, you know, maybe mom decides to give you ballet lessons and then all of a sudden somebody recognizes some talent. So I got that impression from that's why this guy was so good, because that's all he did and the government pushed him.
Yeah, I mean, their system really didn't leave a lot of room for people to say, I do or do not want to do this. If you were sort of judged to have the ability, this is what you're going to do. And I've seen footage of children sort of being evaluated for entrance to the ballet school in St. Petersburg, and they're 4 or 5 years old, standing there in their underwear, and their limbs are being stretched up and down. And other European dance schools will x-ray children to see if they'll be able to get the turnout they needed. But it was such an interesting time for dance, because when these dancers like Mikhail Baryshnikov and Rudolf Nureyev defected, we took it as such a national compliment, because here are these incredible artists who were made in this system that was so different than ours and were the pride of this nation, but they chose to come here because especially Baryshnikov was just driven for artistic freedom and wasn't content to sort of keep dancing what he was told to dance. So I think that was a really interesting dynamic, and there was a lot of pride in these artists that we hadn't made but who had come to us.
Now, as far as we talked about Joan Joyce going to Paris and then meeting Rushkoff, but when the novel opens, you talk a little bit about Joan, and she's petting some dachshunds and thinking about her pregnancy. And right here, where our listeners probably going, wait a minute, where you're taking us from Paris to where she's petting dachshunds and thinking about her pregnancy. So you take us back and forth in the novel, and a lot of authors do that, and it's a kind of a neat way to see, oh, that's how that happened. So you want to tell us why you decided to start it like that?
Sure. So as I mentioned, it was a short story, and the short story just progressed forward through about 20 years in short sections. And then when I sat down to maybe expand it into a novel, I just happened to begin with a scene of this young dancer in the wings, not really paying attention to what's happening on stage, but petting these dogs. And then as I wrote it, really, the structure evolved pretty organically. I would write forward and then get to a place where I felt a piece of information was missing, and then I would jump back in time and sort of write from the moment where that missing piece of information happened. And so it allowed me to really move through space and time with a lot of freedom. And actually, my earlier drafts were even more sort of chopped up and jumpy than the book is. And my editor very nicely told me that this was very confusing. So it had to be consolidated to a degree. And it's also written all in present tense. So I tried to keep sort of an immediacy to it while at the same time covering, I think the book covers about 30 years, ultimately.
Now, as far as what we're talking about, and there are a lot of examples that come to my mind, like immigration, bank robberies, getaway cars. And the reason I mention that is because after Joan comes back to the United States, she gets back in touch with Rushkoff, and he has a favor to ask of her.
Yes, he does, a big one. So Rushkoff in the novel defects and is a very high-profile defector. And I actually used Baryshnikov's method of defection as sort of a model and maybe a little bit as a tribute, which is that Baryshnikov was seen as a defection risk by the Kirov and wasn't allowed to tour in the West because they were worried he'd sort of make a break for it. And then for some reason, he was allowed to go to Canada with a small troupe of really second-rate dancers. And he got in touch with friends while he was there, and then he just basically ran out the back door of a theater and into a waiting car. And that's where the story really diverges from what he did, where Baryshnikov stayed in Canada for a little while and actually danced with Canadian companies before he finally came to New York. But in Astonish Me, the getaway car driver is none other than Joan, who is not a very good driver, for starters, and has no experience with this sort of thing, but Arslan's kind of taken a shine to her, and so she's the one who drives him away from the theater and actually across the border to New York.
In your mind, what made you choose Joan driving the getaway car? You already mentioned Baryshnikov, but the fact that Joan was driving and she's not a very good driver.
It's funny. There's so many decisions that go into writing a book, and I definitely can't recreate a lot of them. It's all just sort of lost to me. It's almost kind of an impulse, like, oh, I should have a turkey sandwich for lunch, or, oh, I should have Joan drive the getaway car. And since I wrote it maybe 3 years ago now, that sort of specific impulse is lost to me. But it was a way, I think, to bring them together and to create sort of a funny structure of indebtedness where she has done him a really big favor and is sort of linked to his myth in the public mind and in the narrative of how he came to the U.S. Meanwhile, she completely worships him as a hero, and so they have a really complicated power dynamic.
Now, they do have a relationship, and Joan almost worships him. However, I'm wondering, and the listeners perhaps may be wondering as well, did Ruzhkov already have this plan in mind that he was going to leave Joan and find somebody else?
I think it never occurred to him that he would stay with Joan. I think he knew that he's this person who's so attractive, both just in his basic being, but also in being this incredible superstar. He's probably the best dancer in the world when he defects. And he's someone with unlimited options, and he's very young. He's in his 20s, and self-absorbed. I mean, in a way, just the act of defection is something you do for yourself because the people you leave behind are punished. So I think he, from the beginning, is just at any given moment, he kind of takes what he wants, and he wants Joan at that moment, and I think he fully expects to tire of her and have many, many other lovers, and he kind of carries out his plan.
It's interesting that, is his first name Arshian?
Arshian,
where he says that he wanted to marry a very good dancer and that Ludmilla had that qualification, mm-hmm. but Joan did not. Those words must really have hurt her.
Oh, yeah. I think because he's someone who has so much talent, he's also arrogant and he almost fetishizes talent and he sort of thinks that only a woman that approaches his level of talent is sort of worthy of him. And Joan, as someone who's just a member of the Corps, is not, even though he was strongly drawn to her in the first place and had written her these letters before he defected. And I think she was kind of a symbol of America, and the promise is there for him.
Do you think that perhaps this is a cultural thing from his home country?
Perhaps. I think it's more of a dance world thing, really. Although, I guess that's true. In, you know, the Soviet Union, you were talking about just the system that was in place to elevate the most talented people. I think, yeah, that would really seep into your psyche. And you would see yourself sort of as at the top of this ladder, and maybe appropriate mates are also at the top of other ladders. And, yeah, I think it would be difficult in some ways to see beyond that.
Well, as we mentioned, you go back and forth in time in the book, and when you open, she is petting dachshunds and thinking about her pregnancy, which, you know, she's trying to hide so she can spend a few days dancing before she marries her high school friend, Jacob. So mm-hmm. How did that relation reestablish?
So Jacob has sort of always loved Joan and is not a dancer and is a little bit younger than she is and very, very smart. And she's always sort of had him in the back of her mind as a potential option when she needs a really good person to sort of start a non-dancing life with. And so she's gone to visit Jacob kind of as her relationship with Arslan is finally ending. And she's pregnant and still dancing because she's not showing yet. And pregnancy for dancers is such an enormous deal. And often the dancers who can have children and then come back and resume their careers are only sort of the most famous dancers who everyone's willing to wait for and give them months off and wait for their bodies to sort of heal and for them to get their strength back. And so lower level dancers often don't really have the option, especially in the 70s. Like now, dance medicine is better. Sports medicine generally is better. Dancers, I think, generally take a little bit better care of their bodies. So when the book opens, she's at a juncture in many ways, both with knowing she's going to stop dancing, she's going to have a baby, she's going to be with a nice man instead of this sort of megalomaniac dancer. But I think she also feels in a way like she's giving up, like to her stopping dancing and almost using the baby as an excuse feels a little bit like a defeat or like she's throwing something away.
However, as we learn later in the book, that's not the case because her children are involved in dancing. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But you also focus on the events that take place between 73 and 2002. And we're focusing on Ruskov and what happens to him. And it also illuminates Joan's history as a dancer, wife, mother, and eventually a ballet teacher, whose star pupils include her son, Harry. Let me ask you about this, because this is something that we hear a lot about, especially with athletes. Athletes who were good but never really made it, they want to live that dream through their child. So is Joan doing that with Harry?
I think Joan is really ambivalent about the idea of Harry dancing. And he doesn't start until he's, I can't remember, he's 9 or 10. He's a little bit on the older side. Lots of people who become professional dancers start when they're 4 or 5. And so she sort of asks him if he wants to dance, and he kind of says no. But he has sort of this crush on the next door neighbor's daughter, Chloe, and Chloe dances. And so one day he's at the studio just kind of waiting for Joan to take him home and gets sort of sucked into Chloe and some friends are goofing around with pointe shoes. And so his interest is sort of piqued. And even as a child, he sees it as a way of getting close to this little girl who has this sort of childish crush on. And so I think Joan had made a bargain with herself not to push him to dance. But then once he starts and it's clear that he has a really serious talent, I think it's irresistible to her that she wants to see if he has what she didn't have and how far Harry can go as a dancer.
And Chloe and Harry are some of the best dancers in the company, correct?
Yes, they're both very talented, which is probably unlikely that next door neighbors would both have very talented ballet dancer children. But part of the idea of the book is that it's meant to feel like a ballet and have that like slightly elevated dramatic quality. So I just said go for it.
As I mentioned earlier, you do not have a ballet background. However, not only did you do your homework, I mean, you could have probably gotten a PhD and written a dissertation on what you did, but it shows your knowledge of ballet, and including, as you mentioned earlier, the laws of anatomy, training, drive, devotion, and what determines success, how people keep on going, and the fact that, you know, the letdowns when you find out that you can't make it and you're not as good as you thought, or you are good but not as good as other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I'm glad you think so. I think my knowledge of ballet is sort of inevitably superficial, though, just because I'll never know what it's like to inhabit a body that way. You know, the idea of being able to stand on the toes of one foot and lift my other leg over my head is just utterly alien to me. So I think a lot of this book, and really my first book too, people say write what you know, but I think probably a better way to phrase it is write what you wonder about. And I really wonder what it's like to have that kind of physical existence. And I think, you know, also when you're a working artist, and are thinking about a different sort of art form and people's practice within it. I think, you know, in some ways writing about ballet is writing indirectly about writing and what you do with your own limitations. And as you said, you know, the frustrations of seeing people who seem to write or dance exactly what you would like to do and how there's always a little bit, I think Zadie Smith said there's a little bit of sadness, just that your work will never quite be what you want it to be. And I think that's true of most artists, that the idea you have in your head of what you want to put out, you can never quite equal that. So that was a source of interest for me as well.
You talked earlier about your editor. Let's talk a little bit about the book. When people find out that it's a book or a novel about ballet, I'm sure that it attracts a certain target audience. But when you find out, as we've been talking about, you can relate the Cold War to it. You can relate control, a lot of allegories, a lot of metaphors. This is more than just a ballet book. So when you took it to your publishers and your editors, What did they say? Did they say something like, a ballet book will never sell?
It was such a funny sequence of events because I wrote this book almost by accident. I wrote it really quickly in about 5 months, right before my first novel, Seating Arrangements, was published. So my editor at Knopf, my publisher, started reading my manuscript just a few weeks before Seating Arrangements was published. And ordinarily, they don't expect a second book from you before the first one's out. And so she was kind of like, okay, you know, I'll take a look. And she liked it and really believed in it from the beginning. I think she's a very open reader. And there really aren't very many ballet books out there. So I think they're often interested in a book that seems to sort of step into relatively uncharted territory. There are some very good ballet books, but I think because it's perceived as a niche interest, often people will think, oh, I don't know anything about ballet. I don't necessarily want to read that. But you really don't need to know anything about ballet to read this book or some of the other ones out there. And for me as a reader, I always like to read about worlds that are strange to me. So yeah, I was sort of banking on the openness of readers and hoping that would be the case.
One of the focuses, as I mentioned earlier too, is control in mm-hmm. this book. And that is, you know, Jacob being whisked to marriage when he's only 24. Mr. Ruskoff controlling Joan when he picks her to help him defect. And then again, when he abandons her. So it's all about control and what you can do. And depending on who you are, like you said, Mr. Ruskoff is a superstar. Jacob worships Joan. And so sometimes we do things and we don't see it as being controlled. What about as far as the book? Is it out on Kindle, ebook? Is it on audio?
Yeah, it's available in all those formats and any sort of reputable bookseller, and then any independent bookseller, if they don't have it, they'd be happy to order it. Yeah. And the audiobook is actually really excellent. The woman who reads it does an incredible series of accents, and she can do a Russian accent. She can do a strong Russian accent, and then she can do the Russian accent of someone who's been in the U.S. for many years, and she's a wonder.
You know, it's incredible how audiobooks have leaped in the market. And it used to be, this book is being read by, and now they'll say, this book is performed by, because as you mentioned, they are doing a vocal performance, and they're doing an acting like old-time radio drama. And again, there are some very good narrators out there.
Yeah, it's true about audiobooks, and I think it's great because it attracts now a real high caliber of reader. The woman who read my book actually came to a reading I did in L.A., and I was so glad I didn't know it was her until afterward, because I would have been really self-conscious about how I read the book, because she does such a beautiful job.
So did she just approach you and say that I would like to read your book?
No, there's a producer through my publisher who chose her, and with Seating Arrangements, I had a choice of a few actors, and this book, they seemed really confident that they wanted this particular actress. So it's been interesting. I don't know if you've ever listened to the Harry Potter books on audio, but the man who reads them is just incredible and rightfully famous now for it, I think.
No, but, you know, I teach announcing and voice acting here, and I have them listening to audiobooks, and Scott Brick is one of them that I have them listen to, and I forget who is reading The Orchardist by Miss Corbett. I forgot her name. And he has an incredible voice. And there are a lot of other people who, because of audiobooks, they go back to reading the actual book. So, because as you know, this generation, we're losing them as far as reading, unless it's on Facebook or on some social media, they will not pick up a book. But I think audiobooks are great for traveling, great for riding on the subway, whatever.
Yeah, when I was in graduate school in Iowa, I drove between Iowa and Southern California about 10 times in 2 years with my dog, and I absolutely relied on audiobooks. But I hope that's not true about young readers. I feel like just the incredible market for young adult fiction now is maybe a good sign that young people are reading, and I think once you read one good book, you want more, so I am cautiously hopeful for the future.
Well, you know, James Patterson recently donated a lot of money to small bookstores, local bookstores, but he also is writing books for, you know, juvenile fiction has really taken off with The Hunger Games and a lot of other stuff like that. in Divergent, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I think that'll help.
I hope so.
Well, Maggie, it's been a joy visiting with you, and I thank you for taking the time to be with us. And we certainly hope that people will go out and get a copy of your book. It's called Astonish Me, a novel by Maggie Shipstead. And she is the best-selling author of former book, Seating Arrangements. I shouldn't say former book. It's still a book. But Seating Arrangements was her debut novel, and it was also a prize-winning book. So, Maggie, again, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Louis. It's great.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Perspectives. There are other episodes to peruse. All you have to do is just check out more of the archives here on our website, ktep.org. Thanks for listening.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.